Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
This is episode 301. Welcome back. We had to take a little break last week because of the 300th Freemasonry's Legacy, Freemasonry's Future event. You know, I didn't get home until Sunday. And, you know, usually I pack a little something and have it ready to go for you guys if I'm going to be on vacation or whatever, or Brother Adam decides to put together an episode. Just didn't happen this time around. Do apologize for that. However, we are back. We've got a great reading this week from Adam Thayer, as well as some Masonic Minute and some other news. So let's get right into it. Just want to say thanks to the George Washington National Masonic Memorial for hosting us. It was one hell of a conference. We had so much fun. Thanks to all the vendors, everybody who came out. I got some cool Masonic art. Edgar Alejandro was there. It means a lot that you came out and that you were there supporting us, and it just means a lot. We had Nick Skype in for the conference. It was really fun. Some guys made it, some guys didn't make it. Joe, talking to you, buddy. A good friend, Joe, didn't get to come out, but Brother Mark did, which was fantastic. And I also got to hang out with Brother Scott Duball the whole time. We had a good time. Also, got to throw a huge thanks out there to Brother Trevor, because he gave us a great deal on an Airbnb, and Frater O for your hospitality. You know, it was just a wonderful time. And we did recap the 300 event this last week on TMR. So if you want, go check that out. Also, Brother Greg Knott did a little piece about it when he came out. So check it all out. It was a real fun time. Now, on to some new business. My wife has been looking for the Mason's Lady car decal forever and a day. So long has she been looking for it that she finally just got tired of it. We couldn't find any, so she had the maid. So we made about 20 of them, and we offer them as a pre-sale. We've already sold a bunch of them, but if you want one, head on over to wcypodcast.com, click on support the show, scroll to the bottom, and you'll see them there. You'll see a picture of it. It's a 5x5 vinyl decal. It's white. It says Mason's Lady on it with the heart and everything. Pretty typical. It's pretty fun. Really cool. We've sold a bunch of them already, so I recommend going ahead and ordering them now, because I won't be around too long. And once I run out of this initial 20, the price will go from $9 to $10, and it'll stay there. But for everybody who pre-ordered one of the first 20, we needed to fund that. In order to pay the person who made them, we had to get some funds up front. So check those out. At the end of this episode, we're going to go out with a new song. New to you, that is. An old song, one of my favorites, that is actually covered by a great friend and great brother, Brother Aaron Chauncey, who plays in some bands, is a great musician up in the Attleboro, Massachusetts area. And I had the great pleasure of meeting him at Masonicon, and I heard his rendition of The Wind, a song that was done by Cat Stevens, and I absolutely loved it. So I hope you enjoy that as a little fun thing at the end of the episode. And for now, let's get right into this week's reading, which is by Brother Adam Thayer.
Speaking of the 300th anniversary, I thought I'd kick things off this week with a piece from Freemasonry Today discussing the 300th anniversary. It's titled An Address by Very Worshipful Brother John Hamill, PGSWDB, Deputy Grand Chancellor. Most Worshipful Pro-Grand Master and Brethren, at a dinner party last year, the conversation turned to the idea of time travel, and were it to become possible, which period we would like to go back to. I said that, for something I was involved in professionally, I would like to go back to a specific day and location in London to meet and ask questions of a particular group of people, and that I would like to bring some of them to our time to see what they had given birth to on that day. It will not surprise you to learn that the date I selected was St. John's Day in summer, the 24th of June in the year 1717, and the location was the Goose and Gridiron Tavern in St. Paul's Churchyard. As we know, on that day, representatives of four London lodges came together, elected a Grand Master and Grand Wardens, and resolved to revive the annual feast and quarterly communications, which it was claimed had fallen into desuetude due to the neglect of Sir Christopher Wren, then Grand Master. As we also know today, the resolution was based on a pious fiction, as there is no evidence for there having been any Grand Lodge or Grand Master before 1717. To us, with the benefit of hindsight, The meeting on 24th of June, 1717, was a momentous and historical event, but into the context of the time, a different picture emerges. One of the problems of dealing with 1717 and the first few years of the Grand Lodge is the lack of hard facts to work with. It was not until 1723 and the appointment of William Cowper, Clerk of the Parliaments, as secretary to the Grand Lodge that minutes began to be kept. Of the four lodges which came together to elect a Grand Master in 1717, three are still working today. The Lodge of Antiquity, the Royal Somerset House, and Inverness Lodge, and the Lodge of Fortitude in Old Cumberland. But their early minutes have long been lost, so that with the exception of those elected to the offices of Grand Master and Grand Wardens, we have no records of whom their members were in the years 1717 to 1725, when the Grand Lodge first called for lodges to submit lists of their members, or who attended the meeting on the 24th of June, 1717. What we can deduce from secondary evidence is that the meeting was not a huge assembly. The Goose and Gridiron survived until the 1890s, and just before it was demolished, an enterprising Masonic historian drew sketches of its exterior and measured the room in which the Grand Lodge was formed. The room would have held less than 100 people, who would have had to stand very close to each other to fit into the room. Our primary source for what happened in those early years is the history of the craft with which Reverend Dr. James Anderson prefaced the rules governing Freemasonry in the second edition of the Book of Constitutions he published on behalf of the Grand Lodge in 1738. Because Anderson's history of the craft pre-1717 is more than somewhat suspect, some historians have cast doubts on his descriptions of the events in Grand Lodge from 1717 to 1738. What they forget is that he compiled it on behalf of the Grand Lodge, and that it was vetted by a committee of the Grand Lodge before it went into print. Although writing 20 years after the events of 1717, there would still have been brethren around who were involved in those early years. Not least Reverend Dr. John Theophilus Desgalliers, Grand Master in 1719, and Deputy Grand Master in 1722, 1723, and 1725, who would have been very quick to point out any errors of fact in Anderson's comments on the Grand Lodge. From Anderson's account, in its first years, the Grand Lodge met only for the annual assembly and grand feast to elect the Grand Master and the Grand Wardens. From two other sources, we can deduce that the Grand Lodge began to act as a regulatory body in 1720. Both the 1723 and 1738 editions of the Book of Constitutions include a postscript describing the ancient manner of constituting a new lodge as practiced by the Grand Master George Payne in 1720. A very rare Masonic book entitled The Book M, or Masonry Triumphant, published by a brother Leonard Umfraville in Newcastle upon Tyne in 1736, includes a report of a meeting of Grand Lodge in 1720, in which a code of rules for the government of the craft, compiled by the then Grand Master George Payne, was adopted. The report was followed by the list of 39 rules, which formed the basis of the rules printed in the first edition of the Book of Constitutions, published in 1723. Some have questioned why there were no press reports in the event of 1717, but they have been looking at the past with the eyes of the present. In 1717, Freemasonry was largely unknown. The late 17th and 18th centuries were a great age of societies and clubs, many of them meeting in taverns, and the growing network of fashionable coffee houses in the cities of London and Westminster. If noticed at all, the formation of Grand Lodge would have been seen as just another society. It was not until the early 1720s, when past Grand Masters George Payne and Dr. Desgalliers began to attract members of the nobility and the Royal Society into Freemasonry, that the press of the day began to notice Freemasonry, reporting on the initiations of prominent men of the day and the annual grand feasts of the Grand Lodge. It was not until 1723 that the Grand Lodge became fully established as the regulatory body we know today. By that year, in addition to the keeping of minutes of quarterly communications and the publication of the first Book of Constitutions, the Grand Lodge had extended its authority outside the cities of London and Westminster, issuing deputations to constitute lodges in the provinces, and bringing into the fold some independent lodges that had been meeting quietly in the northern provinces. The rules compiled by Payne in 1720 and published in the Book of Constitutions in 1723 introduced the concept of regularity, stating that no new lodge would be countenanced as regular unless it had been personally constituted by the Grand Master, or a brother deputed by the Grand Master to act for him. At a conference sponsored by our Premier Lodge of Research, Quadricoronati Lodge number 2076, at the Queen's College, Cambridge, last September, two academics gave a paper suggesting that we were celebrating 4 years too early and cast doubts on the meeting of 1717. Having carefully studied their paper, My response is that old-fashioned polite English expletive, balderdash. Their thesis seems to boil down to an academic semantic argument as to what constitutes a Grand Lodge. They appear to think that we were not a Grand Lodge until 1721 because there is no evidence for any attempt at regulation before that date. It is beyond doubt that at the meeting on the 24th of June 1717, Anthony Sayer, Captain John Elliot, and Jacob Lamball were respectively elected Grand Master and Senior and Junior Grand Wardens, officers of a Grand Lodge. The academics appear to believe that, like Athena, bringing fully armed from the head of Zeus for the meeting in 1717 to be accepted as the formation of a Grand Lodge, it should have immediately acted as a regulatory body. Life rarely works that way. And talking of time travel, I said I would like to bring back from 1717 some of those involved on the meeting of the 24th of June. In their wildest imaginings, they could not have envisaged what their simple and small meeting would give birth to. A worldwide fraternity of regular Freemasonry spread over the whole world. They would find some things that they would recognize from their practice of Freemasonry, but would also find much that was very different. Over the last 300 years, Freemasonry has developed and expanded in ways they could not have imagined. What English Freemasonry has demonstrated over the last 300 years is that it is a living organism capable of changing its outward form and adapting itself to the society in which it currently exists. It has had a wonderful knack for making those changes without in any way changing those fundamental and inalienable principles and tenets on which Freemasonry was founded, and which would certainly be recognized by those who met in 1717. The more I study our ancient craft, the more I am convinced that whatever problems we may face from time to time, provided that we maintain the delicate balance between managed change and not altering our basic principles and tenets, Freemasonry will ride over those problems, and future generations will be able to enjoy its fellowship and privileges as we, and the many generations that have gone before us, have done since that happy day in 1717 on which the Grand Lodge was born. All right, up next we have a piece that Brother Robert spoke about last week, entitled Good and Evil, by worshipful Brother Carlos Zapata, with a foreword by Brother Jack Nathan Aquilina. This article was sent to me by worshipful Brother Carlos Zapata after many discussions that we had about his passion for Masonic research and philosophy, in particular his love for writing. I was surprised to hear from worshipful Brother Carlos that despite his incredible skills and knowledge, that he had never actually had any of his work published. In his usual humble manner, he said to me that he would be honored to see his name attached to a published Masonic article that he authored, and to have it displayed on a large Masonic forum. Knowing that worshipful Brother Carlos was a big fan and reader of the Midnight Freemasons blog, I suggested to him that he submit one of his pieces for publication. Not only was worshipful Brother Carlos excited about this idea, he sent me a number of editions of The Evolutionist, a private newsletter he authored monthly for Lodge Evolution in Victoria, that had a large volume of his writings. He asked if there was anything in those newsletters which he authored that could be edited for publishing on this blog. In memory of worshipful Brother Carlos, therefore, this article has been submitted for publishing in dedication to his incredible talent, passion, and skill in Masonic and philosophical research. For many, worshipful Brother Carlos was seen to be a kind, dependable, and knowledgeable brother, who touched and changed the lives of so many of his brothers through his generous sharing of knowledge and further light in Masonry. I hope that by publishing this article, my commitment to worshipful Brother Carlos to see his incredible and inspirational work being published will be fulfilled, and that his incredible gift for education will now continue to perpetually touch the lives of many of whom will now be able to read and learn from his work. We will be forever indebted to him for his kindness and friendship, and it was an honor and privilege to have known him, even if we have lost him too soon. May he rest peacefully in the Grand Lodge above. Good and Evil, by worshipful Brother Carlos Zapata. Lodge of Evolution, number 931, United Grand Lodge of Victoria. For this article in particular, with such a controversial subject, I have compiled and prepared a brief of the theme, Good and Evil, from different contexts, interpretations, and definitions, in light to have a clear picture of it, and of course, is not intended to take a side, but to understand and comprehend their real meanings in our daily life, for the good of oneself, our society, and mankind. It's a dangerous oversimplification to believe that some people are innately good, while others are innately evil or bad. This misleading concept underpins the justice system of many countries. Bad people commit crimes, and since they are intrinsically bad, they should be locked away, so that they can't harm us with their evil behavior. This concept has also fueled many wars and conflicts in history, and even in the present day. It makes groups believe that they are fighting a just cause against an evil enemy, and that once the evil people have been killed, peace and goodness will reign supreme. Human nature is infinitely more complex than this, of course. Good and evil are relative. One person's good is another person's evil. They're also flexible. People can be a combination of good and bad qualities. And some people who behave cruelly and brutally can be rehabilitated and eventually display good qualities, such as empathy and kindness. And rather than being intrinsic, most cruel or brutal behavior is due to environmental factors, such as an abusive childhood, or social learning from family or peers. What do we really mean when we use these simplistic terms, good and evil? Good means a lack of self-centeredness. It means the ability to empathize with other people, to feel compassion for them, and to put their needs before your own. It means, if necessary, sacrificing your own well-being for the sake of others. It means benevolence, altruism, selflessness, and self-sacrifice towards a greater cause, all qualities which stem from a sense of empathy. It means being able to see beyond the superficial differences of race, gender, social context, or nationality, and relate to a common human essence beneath them. Concepts which perfectly fit into the tenets of Freemasonry. Good man, remember? Evil people are those who are unable to empathize with others. As a result, their own needs and desires are of paramount importance. They are selfish, self-absorbed, and narcissistic. In fact, other people only have value for them to the extent that they can help them satisfy their own desires, or to which they can exploit them. I would argue that their primary characteristic is an inability to empathize with others. They can't sense other people's emotions or their suffering, can't see the world from other people's perspective, have no sense of their rights. Other human beings are just objects to them, which is what makes their brutality and cruelty possible. Most of us lie somewhere between the extremes of good and evil on the spectrum of human behavior. Sometimes we may behave badly, when egocentric impulses cause us to put our needs before the welfare of others. Sometimes we behave in a saintly fashion, when empathy and compassion impel us to put the needs of others before our own, resulting in altruism and kindness. The real difference between this idea of good and evil and the traditional concept is that empathy, or the lack of empathy, isn't fixed. Although people with a psychopathic personality appear to be unable to develop empathy, for most of us, empathy, or goodness, is a quality that can be cultivated. This is recognized by Buddhism and most other spiritual traditions. As we practice meditation or mindfulness, and as we become less attached to materialism and status seeking, we become more open and more connected, and so more selfless and altruistic. This is an optimistic view of nature, but I would go even farther. Because the goodness in human beings emerges when we are connected, when we spread out into empathy with one another. It is believed that goodness expresses something fundamental about human nature, even if it might be sometimes difficult to see. Evil is an aberration, a form of pathology, as the psychopathic personality shows, which only emerges when we are broken off into disconnected fragments. How are we to understand and resolve the historic battle of so-called good versus evil in the world? Basically, how are we to make sense of human behavior, specifically the dark side of human nature? In fact, are we ever going to be able to explain the human condition? And more particularly, can we humans ever become truly moral beings? Most wonderfully, the answer to these last two core questions about human beings is the symbol of yin and yang, a certain representation of good and evil in human personality, emphasizing that in the good field could exist little evil, and likewise in the evil side could exist little good. The famous psychoanalyst Carl Jung was forever saying that wholeness for humans depends on the ability to own their own shadow. Because he recognized that only finding understanding of our dark side could end the underlying insecurity in us humans about our fundamental goodness and worth, and in so doing, make us whole. Yes, the agonizing, underlying, core, real question in all of human life has been the issue of our seemingly imperfect, good versus evil conflicted, even fallen or corrupted, so-called human condition. Are humans good? Or are we possibly the terrible mistake that all the evidence seems to unequivocally indicate that we might be? While it's undeniable that humans are capable of great love, We also have an unspeakable history of brutality, rape, torture, murder, and war. Despite all our marvelous accomplishments, we humans have been the most ferocious and destructive force that has ever lived on Earth. And it's this conflicted situation that we needed to find understanding of how are we to understand, and by so doing resolve the battle of good versus evil in the human makeup. How are we to reconcile our yin and yang? Yes, what is the biological explanation for sin, as our far from ideal behavior has historically been termed? What is the origin of sin, and more particularly, how can it be ameliorated? Even in our everyday behavior, why have we humans been so competitive, selfish, and aggressive, when clearly the ideals of life are to be the complete opposite, namely cooperative, selfless, and loving? In fact, why are we so ruthlessly competitive, selfish, and brutal that human life has become all but unbearable, and we have nearly destroyed our own planet? Unable, until now, to truthfully answer this deepest and darkest of all questions about the origin and meaning of our good and evil, human condition, afflicted existence, we learn to avoid the whole depressing subject. So much so, in fact, that the human condition has been described as the personal unspeakable, and as the black box inside of humans they can't go near. Indeed, Carl Jung was referring to that terrifying subject of our good versus evil embattled human condition when he wrote, "When it," meaning our shadow, "appears, it is quite within the bounds of possibility for a man to recognize the relative evil of his nature, but it is a rare and shattering experience for him to gaze into the face of absolute evil." Taoism, also known as Taoism, is an early Christian religion which emphasizes a balance between humans and nature. One must be flexible and go with the flow. Taoism is represented by the yin-yang symbol. The black, or yin, and white, yang, represent polar opposites, such as, but not specifically, good and evil. The symbol also represents the balance between such. There will always be good and always be evil. One cannot exist without the other. Qi is believed to be a vital energy in all things. It's important to allow this energy to properly flow in the body and in the world. Tai Chi is an ancient Chinese exercise that promotes the balance of qi in the body. Feng Shui is the art of allowing qi to flow properly in one's environment. Taoism is the practice of peacefully living in a world of opposing forces, such as good and evil. It's a faith that when good and evil are out of balance, the balance will return. Go with the flow. In Taoism, it's important to be flexible. Taoism addresses good and evil and provides a method for living with them. There is a balance that exists between all extremes. Let us use the example of the pendulum to represent balance in the world. When the pendulum is centered, there is balance. The object is perfectly aligned with its true value. When the pendulum is to the right, the object is overvalued. There will be a correction in which the value lessens. When the pendulum is to the left, the object is undervalued. There will be a correction in which the value increases, which is expressed in the principle of rhythm in the Kybalion. When the pendulum is out of balance, the best solution is a controlled adjustment. This takes a proactive, future-looking approach. Unfortunately, many leaders are short-sighted and only concerned with the near future. They then have to react to unforeseen required adjustments without planning, with disastrous results as a consequence. Napoleon Bonaparte said, "Order marches with weighty and measured strides. Disorder is always in a hurry." War and peace do not last forever. When there is war, have faith that there will be peace. When there is peace, one must be vigilant of conflict and war. There are some things that are out of our control. We must do what we can to fight evil with good. We must also have faith that when things are bad, they will get better. Sometimes we are stabbed in the back. Sometimes people do us wrong. There are many people throughout my life who have done me wrong. There are exponentially far more people throughout my life that have done me right. You'll not always have an opportunity to confront people who are intentionally harmful due to many circumstances, including timing, location, and politics. Likewise, you will not always have an opportunity to thank people who have been kind and generous. When situations like this occur, we need to have faith that there will be a balance. What goes around comes around. Again, the principle of rhythm. One way or another, justice will be served. For the people who have done us wrong, either we let it be or hold on to the anger and injustice. Often we do hold on to that anger, but it subsides over time. I'm not a believer that time heals all wounds. However, it can take the edge off of the pain. Do good and evil really exist in the animal world? I would argue that they absolutely do. The varieties in animal life on Earth are miraculous. Animals exist that can produce light, see with sonar, spin webs, morph into butterflies, and can change color to camouflage with their surroundings. We have predators, and we have prey. There are plant eaters that do not harm other animals, and there are meat eaters that take lives. We have alligators, sharks, piranhas, and mosquitoes. We have swans, dolphins, deer, and fireflies. There are animals that represent all the good and bad qualities of mankind, from unconditional protective love to thoughtless destruction. So what is a good person? Kabbalah reveals the structure of the entire universe to a person, and that person discovers that our world is surrounded by one immense benevolent force called the Creator. And this is the immense benevolent force that conducts the still vegetative and animate nature very rigidly, by forcing that nature to follow its laws with absolute precision. Human beings, meanwhile, process freedom to choose how to behave in relation to oneself and the environment, nature, and society. It turns out that people are misusing the freedom that nature has allowed for them. They don't respond with the same kind of love, filling this void with the attribution of love. In principle, a human being is the only thing in nature that needs correction. There are neither evil nor good forces. There's only one force that guides us to the end of correction by showing us the way, sometimes causing all that suffering in us. This suffering is a consequence in a difference of attributes between me and the Creator. There's no other choice. If I make my attributes like the Creator's, if I bring myself closer to them, I will then enter states that are called spiritual worlds, sensations of the Creator. To the same measure that I entered into these states, I will be sensing goodness and delight. That's why there are no forces other than good forces, and all the evil forces are indeed our own. And these are what we have to correct, our own hearts. The idea that in the divine worlds, no evil exists, is a fundamental Kabbalistic tenet, and is stated repeatedly in Kabbalistic texts. The biblical verse, Psalms chapter 5, verse 4, is often quoted as proof, "Evil will not dwell with you." This is taken to mean that in the worlds where the divine light shines unaltered, no evil can exist. After all, the divine light is God's will, and God wants only good. However, the divine is the root for all that exists. There is no evil in the divine realm, but it must, in some way, serve as a distant root that allowed evil eventually to emerge. Kabbalists say that the distant root of evil is the strict law represented by the divine attributes known as Gevura. Law and rules are in themselves good, but unbending strictness can eventually result in evil. Being God's will is to do only good. Evil cannot develop in the worlds where he is the only determining force. It could only develop in the lower, separated worlds, where other wills are given freedom to operate. There is some debate as to where evil first emerged. The term free will has been used extensively in philosophical and theological works. It is usually assumed that the meaning of the term is clear, but in truth, the term is often used in different ways, depending on the user and the context. Therefore, it should be helpful to clarify what is meant by free will in our discussion here. Firstly, free will implies that there is no external constraint on what is willed. Secondly, it also means that there is no internal compulsion. Nevertheless, even if the prior two conditions are met, there still remains an impediment to total free will. A person does not create himself, nor does he create his environment. The person that supposedly has total free will is not truly responsible for what he is at the moment that he exercises his free will. What he is not his doing alone, but results from the actions of God, who provided both his body and his environment. The difficulty of assigning ultimate responsibility to humans for their deeds is a major problem for theology and will not be solved here. People are never truly independent of their Maker, who is the root of all things. However, the fact that God is the root of man perhaps is what provided the impression that remained after the light was evacuated from the center of the Ein Sof. Ultimately, even after the creation of the empty global area, God remains in charge. Evil is thus an illusionary phenomenon, just like man's total free will. Both are limited, and ultimately, God's beneficence lies hidden behind both. Humans have wrestled with questions of good and evil since time immemorial, without reaching any universally satisfactory conclusion. For Christians, all goodness flows from God's inherent character, and evil is refusing to submit to his authority in love and serve him. The problem of evil's existence is a stickier issue, causing much debate among Christian scholars, theologians, and philosophers. But Christian beliefs define the source of determining what is good and what is evil, describe human nature, and provide Christians with the tools for combating evil with good. Then, what is evil? Evil is generally divided into categories of natural evil, such as natural disasters, diseases, or birth defects, and moral evil, or human action, that result in pain and suffering for others, such as genocide, war, cruelty, exploitation, and abuse. Many Christians hold that moral evil stems from rebellion against God, which results in injustice, vanity, pride, dishonesty, aggression, violence, greed, and more. The belief in Adam and Eve's original sin offers a widespread Christian explanation for how suffering and death were introduced to the world through their disobedience to God. Because of Adam and Eve's fall into sin, Christian tradition holds the belief touted by Saint Augustine that humans are born in a state of sinfulness, unrelated to anything they have yet done, already contaminated with the long-lasting and far-reaching consequences of the original sin. Because of this sin, human beings are separated from God and in need of a Savior to bridge the gap and provide a way for salvation. Humans' sinful nature wars with their desire for God, and according to BBC Religion, explains the tendency for human beings to give in when tempted by the prevailing evil of the society around them rather than standing up for good. As the Apostle Paul laments, "I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate." Many scholars and theologians over the course of history have tried to explain or justify the existence of evil and suffering in light of God's goodness. Christian explanations for evil usually include discussion on the role of free will in human choice, God's corrective discipline and call to repentance, and God's ability to see the big picture better than humans and turn even apparent evil into that which accomplishes his good purpose. Dr. Davies Stofka elucidates, "Free will is not free if we can only choose the good, so God does not prevent us from choosing evil. Suffering is the price we pay for this freedom to choose." Another Christian viewpoint is that although God cannot cause evil and suffering, he may allow it to happen to bring a person to a state of recognition of her need for his salvation and drive her to repentance, or to test her faith in order to make it grow stronger. Because karma is directly concerned with good and evil, discussion of karma must also include a discussion of good and evil. Standards for defining good and evil, however, are not without their problems. What is good, and how is it so? What is it that we call evil, and how is that so? These problems are in fact a matter of language. In the Buddha's teaching, which is based on the Pali language, the meaning becomes much clearer, as will presently be demonstrated. The English words good and evil have very broad meanings, particularly the word good, which is much more widely used than evil. A virtuous and moral person is said to be good. Delicious food might be called good food. A block of wood which happens to be useful might be called a good block of wood. Moreover, something which is good to one person might not be good to many others. Looked at from one angle, a certain thing may be good, but not from another. Behavior which is considered good in one area, district, or society may be considered bad in another. It seems from these examples that there is some disparity. It might be necessary to consider the word good from different viewpoints, such as good in a hedonistic sense, good in an artistic sense, good in an economic sense, and so on. The reason for this disparity is a matter of values. Words good and evil can be used in many different value systems in English, which makes their meanings very broad. Anne Frank once said, "In spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply can't build up my hopes on a foundation consisting of confusion, misery, and death." In the original Star Trek television series, there was an episode where a higher intelligence wanted to know what was stronger, good or evil. This higher intelligence did what any higher intelligent being would do to solve the equation: put a few good people and a few evil people on a barren planet and have them beat each other up. There was a lesson at the end of the episode. It's not about which is stronger in fighting, it's about what they are fighting for. There have been many long discussions over many generations in regard to good and evil. These discussions must continue, and continue often. How do we know who we are without scrutinizing what is good and what is evil? What is the agnostic standpoint? The agnostic approach is difficult, as this discussion is subjective. We follow the wisdom of Socrates that knowledge is good and ignorance is bad. Good is directly related to truth. Knowledge promotes ethical conduct, while ignorance promotes corruption. The purpose of an agnostic is to obtain and promote truth, which is to obtain and promote what is good. What is good often differs from what is popular. So, where do good and evil come from? Good and evil exist in the animal world and the human world. There are insects and animals that have both good and evil traits and instincts. As the most advanced species on Earth, humans are able to magnify the good and evil that exists in animals. So what is good and what is evil? Are the definitions constant, or do they change based on ruling party, society, or religious views and customs? We, and many philosophers past and present, maintain that there are concrete definitions of good and evil. We don't subscribe to the might makes right school of thought. We believe that right makes might. There are actions that are wrong regardless of anything. Acceptance of evil does not make evil good. The definition and impact of evil does not change due to ignorance. Abraham Lincoln said, "Freedom is not the right to do what we want, but what we ought." Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us, to the end, dare to do our duty as we understand it. Good is to create and do good by oneself, one's family, and one's society. Evil is to destroy and do evil by oneself, one's family, and society. There is some evil in good and some good in evil. A new tree in a crowded forest can only live and grow if another tree dies to let in the needed sunlight. Sometimes creation requires destruction. Plant eaters need predators to keep their population steady, or the plant eaters overpopulate and destroy all the vegetation. There is a balance of creation and destruction in nature. Often a society becomes closer and stronger when faced with an evil threat or action. Often a good society can become complacent and lazy when unthreatened, allowing evil to grow from within, unnoticed and unchallenged, until it is deeply rooted. All right, I know that was a bit longer of a piece than what we normally do on the show. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I read it quite a few times over after I heard about it, and one of the first things I did was send a message to Brother Robert and say, if you haven't re-recorded it, please let me do it, because I was so excited to read that. I hope you enjoyed it as well.
This is Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast. And once again, here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, many thanks to Worshipful Brother Adam Thayer for reading that piece by Worshipful Brother Zepeda. I know I had tried to record that last week, and there was some really weird things going on with the audio, so I do apologize we didn't get that in last week, or the week before, rather. And just wanted to thank Adam for reading it, and thanks to Brother Jack Aquilina for sending it over to us. Always appreciated, and truly a profound paper by a profound brother, and we do recognize the loss. So one of the interesting things that is coming up also, which we talked a little bit about conferences, the 2017 Masonic Society Conference is coming up. It looks to be pretty amazing. It's going to be in Lexington, Kentucky at the Embassy Suites, September 7th through the 10th, 2017. The conference theme is Centuries of American Freemasonry, 1717 to 2017, Our Past, Our Present, Our Future. And conference events. So it says that there will be some pretty good speakers there. Looks like Mark Tabbert, who was a phenomenal keynote speaker for us at the TMR event. Brother Oscar Aline, Patrick Craddock, John Ruark. There'll also be some panelists there, including Chris Hodapp and a few other gents as well. So it looks pretty fun. You can visit the website at 2017masonicconference.com, and it actually is a redirect over to lexingtonlodge1.org. When you get there, you got to wait a second for it to come up with the banner for the actual event. So they'll have the program will be there. You can download the PDF. They'll have a speaker. They have some tours going on, sponsors, and a way to register as well. So it looks like registration fee is $125. If you want to go to the festive board, that's $45. If you're a member of Lexington Lodge Number 1, there's no charge. Entries for Kentucky Long Rifle Drawing is $20 each. And it looks like there's a tour of the Kentucky Horse Park at no charge and a tour of Ashland Henry Clay's home at no charge. So it looks like you could pretty much do everything under the sun if you wanted to spend under $200. You get your registration, a ticket to the festive board, and a $20 ticket to win a long rifle. Looks to be pretty cool. So you can register online already. So they have that set up, as well as a phone number. You can call 800-517-7395 for any assistance or questions. But looks pretty cool. Brother Greg Knott recommends it always, as always. And right now, speaking of kind of some celebratory stuff, let's go ahead and go right into this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison.
Years ago, I had a job which required frequent trips to Washington, D.C. I became familiar with the area and bit by bit pretty much saw everything there was to see. And believe me, there is a lot to see. I soon learned you never need to rent a car, you just use the metro. I soon learned you never want to rent a car because the traffic there will break the spirit of even the most seasoned commuter. I became an expert on the District of Columbia's geography. I recall once, I even gave directions to someone to the Russian embassy, a building I called the Porcupine because it had so many antennas sticking out of it. On one occasion, a business associate gave me a tour of Old Town Alexandria. As we strolled down King Street, he probably pointed out a massive 300-foot-tall building to the west, and he probably told me what it was. The fact is, though, I have no recollection of that. I know I saw it because if you're in Alexandria, you'd have to be blind to miss it. That building, I'm sure you can guess, was the George Washington Masonic National Memorial. Didn't go there. Didn't care. You see, for all those places I saw in the D.C. area, I missed two of the most important. That memorial building in Alexandria and the Scottish Rite House of the Temple. The thing is, back then, I was not a member of this fraternity. Fast forward to 2017, the 300th anniversary of the founding of the United Grand Lodge of England. A group of young, dynamic, hard-working brothers decided the U.S. should celebrate the tricentennial along with the UGLE. From that idea, it started out as nothing more than a brainstorm, those brothers assembled a program that was one of the best Masonic forums I have attended. Meeting on June 23rd and 24th, the celebration held at that venerable George Washington Masonic National Memorial included a special tour of the Scottish Rite House of the Temple in D.C. And there I was, able to tour those two important places I neglected to see all those years ago. For me personally, that alone would have made it, in a sense, the trip of a lifetime. But wait, there's more. In addition to the presentations throughout the day, the brothers were insistent on giving every attendee a chance to speak and contribute. One of the most interesting parts of the event was a plenary forum where we discussed and debated topics important to the fraternity. Everyone had a chance to voice an opinion on proficiencies, dues, and other issues. What's more, the attendees themselves, not the moderators, chose the topics. Of course, one of the things that make any such gathering great is the ability to see old friends and make new ones. As my friend and brother Greg Knott from Illinois put it in his essay on the Midnight Freemasons blog, at any of these type of events, my favorite part is meeting and talking with brothers from all over the world. I was particularly pleased to meet a brother from the most worshipful Prince Hall Grand Lodge of Washington, D.C. We had both lunch and dinner together and had some great conversations. I have to say, I had similar experiences. Most agreed another highlight was Brother John Ruark's assessment of statistics he has assembled on the fraternity. Sounds dry, doesn't it? Quite the contrary. In a word, Brother Ruark gave us some amazing information on exactly who we are. Brother Ruark is a member of the group behind this event. In addition to John, these brothers, known for their podcast, The Masonic Roundtable, are Jason Richards, Juan Sepulveda, the newest member, Mike the Intern Hambrecht, and the host of this podcast, Robert Johnson. These are names you would do well to remember, and the Masonic Roundtable is the internet equivalent of must-see TV. Well, as Steve Jobs used to say, there's one more thing. According to Brother Mark Tabbert, keynote speaker for the event, that date, 1717, may be an error. He thinks the correct date for the founding of the UGLE may be 1721. Hey, we're Freemasons. There has to be some controversy. I say, let's have another party in 4 years. The members of the Masonic Roundtable put together an event that would be the envy of any Grand Lodge. Ironically, it was a celebration of Freemasonry's past that may have revealed more about Freemasonry's future. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, and that is it for this week. So I know I didn't read anything, and I know just delivered some news for you this week, but I hope you enjoyed nonetheless. It was, as always, a pleasure to be with you, and please remember to support the show by heading on over to wcypodcast.com, clicking on Support the Show, and of course you can buy any number of the cool things that we offer here, and click the Buy a Pin option where you can get a pin, which is our exclusive lapel pin. You can get tie bars, cufflinks of those same thing. We only have a few tie bars left, actually, so those will be selling out pretty soon, I imagine. You can also check out our sponsors on itlabs.com and buybankersbest.com. Use promo codes, so those are on the website. Check them out. You can get 10% or 20% off, respectively, and both of those websites send a little bit back to the program, including Buy Bankers Best. So if you buy King Solomon's Reserve, we actually get 50% of the proceeds, so it's a really good deal. Brother Levi Banker has given us some great funding. So many thanks to our sponsors. Many thanks to all of you who continue to produce this program through your pin sales and even now the Mason's Lady stickers. So that's really cool. I appreciate that very much. And lastly, I would just like to say a huge thanks once more to all the brothers who came out and everybody I talked to and everybody who participated. It was fantastic, and we look forward to doing it again. I imagine we're going to do it again. I'm not sure if it's going to be this year or next year or what, but you'll know as soon as it happens. And I will tell you, I do also have something else in the works which is related to Freemasonry. It is an entirely different venture, and I will be releasing information on that as it develops. So, with all that, I hope you guys are really excited, rejuvenated, and ready to bring Freemasonry into the future over the course of another 300 years. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I sit upon the setting sun, but never, 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 never. I never wanted water once. Never, 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 never. I'll listen to my words, but they fall far below. I'll let my music take me where my heart wants to go. I swim upon the devil's lake, but never, 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 I'll never make the same mistake. Never, 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 never.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.